So it is an honor to present to you Dr. Mark McClellan.
Larry, thanks for that introduction. Boy, the only thing I'm sorry about is that you didn't I didn't get a recording of all of that that I can have playback in the future. It was quite an introduction, and I also want to give a special thanks to Doug Pace and the LTQA staff for their help in organizing this. The LTQA, I know many of you who are on the call are already familiar with its activities, but it's been doing some very important work and developing measures for what we want in our healthcare system, particularly related to how long-term services and supports can improve care and improve outcomes overall. It's a huge gap in health reform, as I'll talk about more in a few minutes, and also a lot of work related to identifying and educating and supporting best practices in using long-term services and supports to get better outcomes for patients. So it's been a real privilege to work with the LTQA over these last few years, and I think there are even more critical work ahead. And it's also a special privilege to be with all of you on the call today. I know we are nominal, at least, talking about this recent Health Affairs article on unintended consequences of steps to cut reimbursement and to cut readmissions and reform payment. Steps that may have adverse effects for vulnerable older adults. But what I really want to do is use this as a stepping off point for talking about some of the absolutely critical needs for more involvement of long-term services and support in our broader healthcare system level reform efforts. That's really what all the main unintended consequences here are about. It's about sort of the challenges that arise when we don't take that kind of systematic look that recognizes the potential critical importance of long-term services and support in achieving the overall goals of health reform, particularly for chronically ill and frail individuals. And so I'm going to try to talk some about extensions from this work as we go along, and would welcome any comments or suggestions or questions that you all have about that broader topic especially. So I'm going to try to leave plenty of time for discussion. And as Larry said, if there are any questions or need for clarification along the way, you can send those in at any time, and I'll try to use those to make some course adjustments if necessary as well. So just a little bit of context, I talked about some of my work with the LTQA, which is, I think, very important for the topic that we're talking about today. Also, want to say a few words about our work at the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institution, where I am based now. This is an organization that, like many of you do as well, seeks to make a difference at the interface between policy and practically oriented research. We do a lot of work related to evaluations of alternative treatment strategies, alternative payment approaches, alternative benefit designs, a lot of work related to policy implications based on those analyses and evaluations. And also, just because of where we happen to be in Washington, it gives us some opportunities to try to bring different stakeholders together. What we found is that for achieving effective healthcare reform, it's absolutely not sufficient to come up with a really good idea. There needs to be a pathway to get it implemented, and given the importance of a range of stakeholders in activities related to any kind of successful reforms, that kind of consensus development is very important. We work with many of you on the call on various topics, whether it's accountable care organizations and payment reform, other issues related to long-term services and support, performance measurement, met biomedical innovation, a range of topics that have those kinds of features in common. And what I want to emphasize that I will keep coming back to is that, to my mind, there is not going to be a way to succeed in the overall goals of healthcare reform, whether you're a supporter of the ACA or a supporter of alternative approaches. There are further steps that need to be taken. Some of the most important steps involve more integration and a more recognition of how centrally important long-term services and supports can be to achieving these overall reform goals. So we're going to use the paper as a jumping off point for that, and I wanted to emphasize that we view this as a key part of the activities that we are undertaking at Brookings in the months and years ahead, hopefully with some opportunities to continue to work with all of you. You all know the facts on this background slide, how important long-term services and supports are in the healthcare system, and particularly for the people who are the most dependent on our healthcare system. Long-term services and supports now are used by a growing population of older Americans in a more and more diverse set of circumstances and settings. As you all know, there's been a big shift towards more community-based services, and those are expanding in very innovative ways. And also, even the residential services are reforming as well. These services are so important because the patients who receive them are the ones who are most likely to need help in dealing with transitions in care, whether it's a significant worsening of their multiple chronic conditions complicated by frailty, or whether it's taking them on a path towards recovery after an acute treatment, acute stay for one or more of those conditions. And this matters in terms of overall healthcare spending, with, as you can see from the slide, a large share of Medicare costs, and the same thing goes for Medicaid costs related to this population. We talked on in the paper about some of the evidence that many of these costs may be avoidable, that through better care, and in particular through better integration of innovative evidence-based long-term services and support, as well as post-acute care services, it should be possible to significantly reduce these costs and get better outcomes for patients at the same time. But as of now, this is a remaining really critical gap in the delivery of care in our healthcare system. So this slide talked about the importance of transition for older Americans receiving long-term services and supports, with the risk of poor health outcomes from transitions that don't go well, with the risks of iatrogenic events, hospital-acquired conditions, medical errors, which are much more common in this population, with the gaps in terms of quality, especially important aspects of patient experience, of quality of care and caregiver experience with care, with the disproportionate use of emergency services and unplanned hospitalizations, which are also more costly as well. So managing these transitions well can make a big difference. There is a good deal of evidence, as I mentioned before, that it is possible to do better. This is some of the work that the LTQA has been promoting and trying to disseminate as well, with a number of studies, including some randomized trials, demonstrating positive impacts of innovations around transitional care that can lead to important not only improvements in health outcomes, but also reductions in healthcare utilization and costs through steps like fewer rehospitalizations, fewer emergency room visits, and other steps that are a reflection of better coordinated care. Many of these transition services have in common elements that have not been as central in long-term service and post-acute care delivery in the past, things like in-person home visits, patient self-care, telemedicine-supported activities, home visits from health professionals, and other types of integration with innovative primary care services. Many of these services in the evidence-based studies that we've seen involve extensive involvement of nurses as clinical managers or team leaders. These are often ongoing activities that require intervention for some period of time. That may seem costly, but as the studies have shown, the impact on reducing complications, reducing preventable hospitalization and other costly utilization can more than offset those additional costs, or that redirection of care. And there has been a lot of effort, obviously, to try to promote these services in traditional reimbursement arrangements where you get paid more based on volume and intensity. It doesn't necessarily support some of these innovative ways of delivering services. Many types of telemedicine, many types of visits are not reimbursed much or at all. In contrast, additional hospital stays, additional emergency room visits, and so forth have been more traditional part of payment systems in Medicare, Medicaid, and other insurance programs. And so there have been a range of efforts to try to reform that. In the paper, we focused on three policies that were included in the Affordable Care Act that are all intended to enhance transitional care among Medicare beneficiaries. This included the Hospital Readmission Reduction Program, which is new financial incentives for hospitals to avoid readmissions, the National Pilot Program on Payment Bundling, an initiative to enable different siloed pieces of payment to come together more to enable the providers involved in those silos to work together and use resources more effectively. And the Community-Based Care Transitions Program, an outlay program to support testing out innovative further innovations and further applications of innovations in community-based care transitions. So I'll talk in a little bit more detail about each of these in the next few minutes. And so let me start with the Hospital Readmissions Reduction Program. This is a program that's slated to begin a little bit over a year from now. It's something that was mentioned again in the recent hospital payment rule for the coming fiscal year, 2013. It starts the following fiscal year, fiscal year 2014. And under this program, hospitals with excessive adjusted rates of hospitalization, of rehospitalization for certain types of hospitalization, face a financial penalty. This is initially limited to three target conditions, including pneumonia and acute myocardial infarction or heart attack, with the intention of expanding it to a broader range of conditions over time. For the organizations that don't do well on these risk-adjusted readmission measures, the law provides for some support through quality improvement organizations. These are organizations that would operate through patient safety organizations or PSOs, or a lot of these functioning around the country now. And obviously the intent is to provide some financial alignment, to provide a financial incentive, this time in the form of something like a stick, a penalty, to encourage hospitals and those working with them to take steps to reduce preventable hospitalizations. And that means at least the goal is better outcomes from fewer of these complications. So there are a lot of reasons why readmissions occur, and not only occur, but occur very commonly in this population. One set of reasons relates to the lack of coordination between long-term services and supports and the related post-acute services and the hospital stay. And within the program that's going to be implemented, I'm not sure that this, and my co-authors aren't sure that this issue goes away. So the way that the program is set up focuses on the payments to hospitals. It doesn't extend to long-term service and support providers or directly to the other providers that are also involved and also have very important roles to play in taking actions together to reduce the rates of rehospitalization. In addition, to the extent that the methods for preventing hospitalizations are going to be challenging to implement, they represent new practices, maybe new ways of delivering care, maybe requiring some careful, thoughtful investments of time, resources, and money. More technical assistance could also help appears to be in limited supply. The coordination between acute care and long-term service and support providers is not guaranteed, I think in part for the financial reasons that I've just talked about before. And in addition, while this is a shift in the financial incentives, it isn't a it does have its limits. It involves several percent of hospital Medicare payments, and that may be small relative to the additional DRG payments or additional revenues received from further visits to the hospital and further admissions. I think some of the studies that have been done on this question suggest that the financial offset is only partial, that hospitals don't make a lot of money off of driving readmissions. But the point is, it is a matter of degree, that we're talking about somewhat limited changes in financial incentives affecting a somewhat limited set of readmissions, at least initially, on top of a existing payment system that doesn't necessarily do a lot to support either care coordination or investments to prevent these readmissions already. So the result could mean only a limited impact of these programs. And finally, anytime you move towards a more prospective payment system, one that's not just based on the resources used or the cost of care, there is always a concern about providers taking steps to avoid the higher-risk patients or change the way that they report rather than change the way that they really deliver care to get to better measured results without having an actual impact on the outcomes for patients. And so those measurement issues and those incentives towards avoiding costly patients could be problematic. These are complicated issues, and some of my previous research on this question about the impact of payment reforms like this on provider behavior. We've done a number of studies in the past on the hospital on the acute care side, and you might think that, well, discouraging hospitals from taking certain patients is, that's a bad thing, and it's not necessarily a bad thing if the result is that patients end up being admitted disproportionately to hospitals that are better at avoiding readmission. The distribution of patients across hospitals in the U.S. probably isn't optimal and is going to change over the next few years as the care delivery reforms are implemented in different ways in different places, and that could be quite beneficial in getting the patients or the providers that can do the best job for their care. But it is a complicated issue and one that bears watching closely. The second program that I'd like to briefly walk through is the National Pilot Program on Payment Bundling. This is a five-year program that is intended to evaluate an episode-based integrated care payment and associated with that care delivery program. This is a set of episodes that are intended to be structured around acute care hospitalizations for certain conditions. The episodes are run from a few days before the hospitalization through 30 or 90 days post-hospital, so that's a time-limited episode, and it includes a bundled payment for inpatient, physician, and outpatient and post-acute care. Basically, the major payment elements that are covered by Medicare during that episode around an acute care hospitalization. And the intent here is a good one that where again a lot of evidence that this works outside of Medicare and in some of the earlier versions that have been implemented in Medicare, such as the ACE acute care episode demonstration recently and some competitive bidding episode demonstrations implemented in the past. combination of funds enables providers to direct resources collectively in ways that may not be possible if they were each receiving separate payments. So it facilitates potentially some interaction between the hospital providers and the post-acute care providers and supporting transition teams that otherwise might be hard to finance if each of them were just receiving their own separate payment without this kind of emphasis on improving outcomes through an episode-based approach. It does give, because this is an episode-based payment, it gives all the providers involved sort of stronger financial benefits if they can take steps to get overall cost down. And a good way to do that is to get the care right the first time, get the patient out of the hospital sooner, prevent the readmissions, and prevent the subsequent emergency room visits and other potentially avoidable utilization. That means better outcomes and lower costs. And again, this direction of payments moving away from fee-for-service or payments basis on volume and intensity to different siloed providers toward payments that are more collaborative and more directly tied to results, getting complications down, getting overall costs down, is part of a more fundamental and widespread trend in the healthcare system right now. So this is an area where long-term services and supports could fit right in. But there are some challenges here too. A particular challenge, given what I was talking about earlier, with the fact that most of the patients who have frailty and multiple chronic conditions have some ongoing long-term service and support care, and really that may be their primary source of care, I guess you could say, and that's the providers who are seeing them on a regular basis, who get to know them best and have the most ongoing interaction with them. Those long-term service and support providers are pretty much excluded from the bundle. I don't think that's completely true, because in some cases the post-acute services can be provided by the same providers who are doing long-term service and support. Because Medicare doesn't include long-term services and support in its payment system, it's not surprising that this component is excluded. It just means that there is a residual kind of very important kind of fragmentation in payments, despite the goal of this whole program to have more coordinated payments that promote better integration and more working together to get costs down within the episode. Second concern, and this goes to the importance of long-term services and support as well, is that the paying more at a bundled level within the episode may do some very good things to encourage efficiency of care and prevention of complications within the episode, but it doesn't do anything directly to address some of the challenges of preventing episodes in the first place. So we were talking before about hospitalizations such as for pneumonia or acute myocardial infarction. In many cases, the least expensive episode and the highest quality episode for conditions like that is avoiding it in the first place. And one of the challenges of episode-based payment reform in general is that the episode payments may detract attention away from getting the number of episodes down, preventing the complications in the first place. That's why in some of the other reforms that we see implemented around the country, these episode-based reforms are often paired with other more population-based payment reforms. For example, accountable care organization payments whereby the providers involved would get some new financial support for coordinating care within the episode, but they would also be facing some additional accountability for preventing avoidable episodes in the first place through population-based measures, say, of reducing the rate of hospitalizations with pneumonia or a heart attack or other heart disease complications and the like. So for those kinds of reasons, while this is a potentially useful step, in itself it doesn't create the kind of integration that's really needed to solve the challenges of care for chronically ill, frail patients. For that to happen, there needs to be more primary care and community-based long-term services and support integration, also institutional long-term service and support, where that's the base for the patients being treated, and these episodes don't go to that level. And so that means that, you know, as this program unfolds, again, it may have some important beneficial impact on cost and quality, but it's probably not going to end up being focused on the interventions that can prevent the episodes in the first place, the kind of the more central role that long-term services and support could play in avoiding readmissions and the like than a program that had a more comprehensive strategy involved. In terms of some other complications, you know, again, there's maybe this issue of limiting referral networks, which could be good or bad. Good if the networks are set up around hospitals and post-acute care and other providers that really are doing a better job of preventing the readmissions. Potentially problematic if this leads to access problems for the higher risk patients. And then within the episode, as with all these kinds of payment reforms, it may create some incentives for withholding or avoiding needed care, as well as non-preventable and avoidable utilization, or shifting that care outside of the bundle period. To address these kinds of challenges, steps like implementing these reforms along with more comprehensive reforms, as I was just describing, or implementing them in a phased approach where the performance measures to demonstrate that care isn't getting worse are also improving over time. As I mentioned at the outset of this call, we don't have nearly as good measures involving particularly patients with long-term and frailty, you know, long-term service and support frailty and like other conditions as we like, and that is going to be a challenge to the successful implementation of this program. So let me turn now to the third program, the community-based care transition program. This is a $500 million basically grant program available to participating community-based organizations teaming with hospitals that with the goal of providing transitional care services and getting the readmission rates down through more effective transitional care services. The participating organizations need to have a plan for implementing better evidence-based care transition models, and the slide shows some examples of what these transition strategies can include, and these are again all based off of an increasing evidence foundation. And they target high-risk beneficiaries, exactly the population that we've been talking about for most of this call, those with multiple conditions, potentially coexisting with cognitive impairment, depression, other history of multiple readmissions, and other factors that place them at high risk. And again, I think this program and the idea of supporting community-based care transitions and identifying effective innovations in community-based care transition management is a very promising and very important set of ideas. But once again, there is a recurring theme here of needing to have a focus that expands beyond hospitals. So viewing the hospital as the hub of the care transition may lead to missing some patients that are not well served by that model. There may be some challenges in getting the right patients enrolled in the program. And then once again, for effective transition management in this population, you really do need to pay attention to long-term services and supports that are typically not covered by Medicare. Many of these patients are dually eligible or are getting services outside of Medicare, and not having explicit strategies to deal with that is, at least so far, a missed opportunity for providing more effective support for community-based care transition. So this leads to some of our policy recommendations in the paper, and not surprising to any of you is that we don't think that the Affordable Care Act is going to be the last word. I think that's true whatever happens with the election. There is going to be an increasing emphasis on steps to address rising health care costs, and is going to be an emphasis on steps to address the sustainability of the Medicare and Medicaid programs in a very fiscally challenging time. And there is no way to address those kinds of problems, the costs of entitlement, without a much more extensive focus on the patients who need and depend on long-term services and support. So I think the challenge for all of us is helping to find a way forward to do this more effectively. So there were these efforts in the ACA. There's some ideas on both sides of the aisle. They have not yet been incorporated as much as they need to be in Medicare and Medicaid policies and our other healthcare policies. And so this is should be a major area of emphasis for all of us in the year ahead. And going beyond these programs in the Affordable Care Act, this is one jumping off point for those efforts. So we've talked about some of the unintended consequences that we should anticipate with the reforms that are intended to promote fewer readmissions, better transition management, and better coordination of acute care with the other services that these patients need. In addition to thinking about what those are in advance, that means that we can do a better job of paying more attention to monitoring how we're doing. We need better performance measures to do this. Again, this is where LTQA has made a difference in getting some relevant measures into the so-called endorsement process, the National Quality Forum, getting under consideration by CMS and state Medicaid programs and private payers. Much more needs to be done there. If you can't measure it, it's awfully hard to support it. I know the measures aren't perfect, but with the kinds of cost pressures that are coming, and with the fact that a lot of these reforms are being implemented, better performance measurement around issues related to the quality of long-term service and support is really critical to developing better support and more resources for long-term service and support going forward. With those better measures, it's possible to do more to advance payment policies that integrate care, and in particular that incorporate long-term services and support more effectively. This includes some of the steps that I've already described. It also, such as extending readmission penalties and other to a broader range of conditions. It also includes taking steps to make it easier for coordinating the payment streams to long-term other providers of care that go beyond those included in the existing Medicare episode payments and the like. This goes for CMS further efforts around accountable care organizations and the like as well. These need to go hand in hand with delivery system reforms. One of the big challenges that we see is that it's not easy to implement steps that reliably and significantly reduce readmissions. These are very difficult populations to deal with that have very complex care needs that face a lot of gaps in our existing healthcare systems and infrastructure. But the more that we can take identifiable steps to improve care along with identifiable steps to support those reforms in care through better payment, and in an era of tight resources, the only better payment is going to be coming from redirecting resources, and that's why those better performance measures are so important. But with better performance measures that are tied to identifiable opportunities to improve care, to reduce readmissions, to take other steps that can get unnecessary costs out of the system, it's possible to do this. And the good news is that we know a lot more about how to combine those steps than we did just a few years ago. And my hope is that we're going to be able to build on that relatively quickly. And this is something that is very important to us at Brookings. It's been behind a lot of our major initiatives to date around such areas as accountable care organization implementation and getting to consistent implementation of meaningful performance measures, including outcome measures and other measures relevant to the impact of long-term service and support providers. It really means doing more to bring together acute, post-acute, and long-term care communities to implement healthcare reforms that improve health and lower costs, especially for patients with complex needs. As I said, we've been undertaking this in both payment reform efforts. A lot of people have viewed steps like medical homes and episode payments and accountable care organizations all as sort of good things to try. And, you know, we'll try out each one of these and maybe tweak them a bit, try out different variants in different places. I think that's potentially informative, but what's really needed is some steps that combine all of these. For example, as I talked about before, medical homes are a very good step to provide better support for primary care providers to manage the needs of patients and coordinate their care. But if they're not paired with steps that promote the better working together on the other side, away from primary care, from the specialists involved, the institutions involved, the long-term service and support providers involved, they're not going to have nearly as much of an impact as they could. And that's where steps like episode payments implemented jointly with medical homes could help, and implemented jointly with accountable care organization reforms could help. So these can all be reinforcing with steps that get primary care providers, specialists, long-term service and support providers all aligned better in doing what they want to do, which is deliver better care for patients. And again, given the limited resources, that means it needs to come with accountability, come with performance measures, but we're making progress on that. So it provides a mechanism for aligning payments and delivery reforms. Same thing on the benefit side. In many private plans now, there are a lot of efforts underway to enable beneficiaries to share in savings when they take steps to prevent complications through their own behavior changes, or take steps to prevent costs by identifying higher quality providers that are going to get them out of the hospital sooner. They're going to prevent some of the unnecessary costs. Well, giving patients more of an opportunity to share in those savings could reduce some of the very high financial burden that they're facing, and give them more support to use care more effectively as well. So these are going to be a major focus of our upcoming healthcare reform efforts. And as I said at the outset, and hopefully it's been a recurrent theme through my remarks, the need for long-term service and support to be better integrated into these hopefully truly comprehensive health reform efforts is really tremendous. So in addition to the work that we're doing at Brookings, I want to give one more shout out to the LTQA, which has already been doing a lot to identify best practices and share them. We need to work together to get better measures in place that can support payment reforms that go beyond the kinds of reforms that I've described today, and more directly involving long-term service and support and post-acute care providers. We need to support those through better performance measures. We need to support those through more steps on the benefit design side, so that all of this is moving in the direction of creating a much better environment for high quality, efficient care for our nation's heaviest users of healthcare, and the ones who have the most to gain through better coordination and overcoming all the gaps that exist in our healthcare system today. So thank you for taking the time to listen to me through all of this, and for using our health affairs paper and these particular provisions in the ACA as a jumping off point to highlight what I see as some both unique opportunities and some unique challenges for long-term service and support providers going forward. I hope that what you've taken away from this is that while the challenges are big, while the programs in place now don't do nearly as much as they need to do to support effective coordinated care for high-risk, frail patients with multiple chronic illnesses, the fundamentals are moving in your direction, and moving in the direction of much bigger role of long-term service and support, because frankly, there's no better way and there's no other way to get to the goals that we need to achieve for our healthcare system in terms of much better quality and lower cost. Thank you all very much for the time with me today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or take any suggestions as well.
Thank you, Mark. If you would like to ask a question now, if you will punch star 2, it will put you in the queue. And to kick it off, Mark, we have one on the email component of this. It says, what do you see as the role of services like nutrition, transportation, chronic self-management, other services that are non-medical? Do they really have an important role? And how will they eventually fit into things like accountable care organizations?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I do think they can have, and obviously for some patients, they do have a very important role in preventing costly medical utilization. I think the challenge with those services, as well as a lot of others that you know historically haven't been well reimbursed in our healthcare system, or to the extent they provided, they have to be provided through other financing means, you know, self-pay, you know, volunteer efforts, efforts supported by area agencies on aging, and so forth. They have not been as well integrated with care as they might. And, you know, one of the main advantages I see of these moves, you know, even if they're, you know, piecewise incomplete, like the episode-based payments, the readmission penalties, and then I think the more promising steps around accountable care and a comprehensive strategy for implementing a number of these payment reforms together, is that they hold the potential for generating new sources of support for those kinds of services to the extent that they can be targeted to patients that would otherwise have had higher costs. So typically these days, in these tight fiscal times when these reforms are being implemented, ACOs and so on, they come with this accountability piece that, you know, we the payers are not just going to pay more for additional services and cross our fingers and hope that costs will come down. We're going to give more flexibility to the providers who are involved in delivering care, but the providers have some new accountability to show that they're actually getting costs down and quality up. And while that's challenging, it does mean that to the extent that nutrition services or some of these other services, medication management, AAA activities that have been viewed at least financially as separate from care delivery and the financing of care delivery can come in. But, you know, this is where we really need to have evidence that the patients who are getting these services are the ones who can do better as a result, that will have fewer, you know, less use of healthcare, fewer complications, impact on those measures that I was talking about before. And that's where I see a lot of potential, and maybe go beyond that and say that, you know, I don't see any way to get...
The next question is from...
Steve Jennings.
Your line is now open.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't see any way to get there, to get to the lower cost unless we have these kind of more fundamental changes in the way that we think about healthcare. So these things that are not traditionally part of healthcare become regarded as more part of it for the right patient. So the care is more personalized, more individualized. Doesn't mean we pay for everything for everybody, but it does mean that we do have a broader, more integrated scope of services that can be better targeted to individual patients.
All right, next question.
Mark, you're focusing, and I think for good reasons, very much at the federal level and at federal policy. But at the moment, some of the most energetic and, I think, innovative work that's going on is going on at the state level. And it doesn't seem as if we have much of a mechanism to harvest those lessons as they are occurring. And I worry that we think it takes us a long time to figure out the lessons from the federal initiatives, wait till we see how long it takes to get lessons from the state initiatives percolating up to federal awareness. Are you dealing with that at all, is Brookings?
Yeah, we are trying to deal with that. Let me put an even finer point on it. You know, one way of interpreting the recent Supreme Court decision, I know most people have focused on, the individual mandate and the core of the law was all upheld with Justice Roberts ruling about the individual mandate being attacked. What I think has gotten less attention is the ruling on Medicaid, which gives states, in effect, and that was not a closed ruling, that was 7-2. That was, I think, probably the biggest surprise in the court decision. But what it effectively does is give states more negotiating position in designing their Medicaid programs and, by extension, their, I think, interactions with the federal government more generally. So some people have commented on, well, this means that, you know, some states might not expand Medicaid as much as they would otherwise, and I think that's, you know, certainly going to be true in some cases. I think more generally what it means is that there's an even more of a shift in power or in the way that the federal and state governments interact to give states more flexibility. Now, that can be worrisome for some. I think if you sort of take this is the ruling of the Supreme Court and this is the way things are going, the reality is, Steve, building on what you said, that there is going to be a lot of variation out there in how states are dealing with dual eligibles and how states are dealing with vulnerable populations more generally. And you're right that there aren't as many resources available to help states get this right as there has been much attention paid to it as there has been at the federal level. So we are doing some work with some states on this. This is an area where I think the LPQA could usefully do some work too. States' budgets are very strained these days, and they don't have a whole lot of money for staff in-house to implement and oversee some of these reforms. So we are trying to develop some good models for how, you know, accountable care could be done involving Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries that some states are interested in pursuing. But it is I think a really critical area for health reform and for long-term services and supports in particular.
All right, we got another call.
The next question is from
Loretta Cage.
Your line is now open.
Hi. During your discourse, you voiced some concern that with this focus on acute care and the focus to keep people out of the hospital, that the long-term care services would not be available to the other frail, older people who we serve typically. What do you think the role of assisted living will be in that?
Well, Loretta, I think assisted living, like, you know, the broadening scope of long-term service and supports generally is becoming more important for certain kinds of patients. And, you know, I do think that the more that we can shift the focus from the acute care side only to the overall needs of patients, and again, the best way to do that is through measuring it, because if you can't measure it, you can't support the, you know, it's not very easy to support the payment reforms, that those kinds of steps can help lead to more support for assisted living and other types of services that just work best at the lowest cost for certain kinds of patients. And, you know, I until we get a broader focus in these episode reforms and in the accountable care payment reforms more generally that brings in long-term service and support costs and payments, it's going to be harder to do that. So I think there is a real concern there. But, you know, again, the good news is I think people are starting to recognize this and that we're starting to see some reform efforts that do try to include assisted living providers, other long-term service and support providers, by recognizing that, you know, by including them, they can help get the costs and the complications down on the acute side.
So at a minimum, then, to be recognized, assisted living is going to have to start collecting data that can be measured.
Yeah, I don't see a way around that. And I think if there is a message that I want to get across, it's that it's not only collecting data that we think for professional reasons is relevant to quality, but collecting data that is relevant not only to the assisted living site, but to the overall outcome of the patient. So data that helps make the connection between things that happen in assisted living and the rate at which patients are hospitalized and rehospitalized. You know, again, getting beyond just this rehospitalization focus, which isn't enough. I think there's probably even more that you know, good assisted living providers and other long-term service and support providers can do to prevent the hospitalizations in the first place. But unless you have the data, unless you can create measures demonstrating that impact, you're not going to get financial support given how tight the financing is these days.
All right, we have come to our appointed hour. We want to thank Dr. Mark McClellan for his leadership on these vital issues. Let me just say, in the way of a commercial, we will repeat this particular webinar on August 28th, and it will involve Dr. David Grabowski. Secondly, you need to know that the LTQA is also working on a paper related to the Medicaid end of things. I think Dr. Jenks brought up earlier that will be out later on this fall. If you're interested in joining the LTQA or getting involved, go to our website, and it can tell you how, but it's quite a remarkable gathering of people like Dr. McClellan and those that have authored this provocative article today. So we invite you to get involved. Dr. McClellan, thank you so much for what you have done and are doing for so many, and we look forward to keeping track of the great work that you're doing. And thank you all today for your participation. We'll be emailing you a survey, which we encourage you to give us feedback for future programs. So thank you all, and have a great rest of the day. So thank you all, and have a great rest of the day.